Let's turn again to Genesis chapter 4, and we will finish up that chapter and move along beyond it into as many chapters as we can cover in the time allotted. That will probably only be chapter 5, but we might get further. We'll see. I'm actually looking forward to the session where I'll actually end at the end of a chapter. It looks so much nicer on the tape label if it just says chapters something through something instead of chapter 3, verse 20 through chapter 4, verse 15 or something like that. Anyway, we're now at chapter 4, verse 16. Cain has killed Abel. God has confronted him about it. God has announced his judgment, and yet God has said that he will nonetheless show favor, at least insofar as marking Cain, making him, giving him some distinguishing visible characteristic, which would make him instantly recognizable as Cain, as opposed to someone else, so that people might be all the more careful not to do harm to him when they see him, because God has put a special protection on him. This is incredible, the mercy of God. You know, it's amazing how people often say, well, it seems like the God in the Old Testament, he was a vengeful, judgmental God, and in the New Testament, we got an entirely different picture of God as the merciful God. I don't see that difference at all. I've never been able to see that difference. I think the people who say that have not read the Old Testament or the New Testament with their eyes open, apparently, except to see what they want to see. But there are astonishing instances of God's mercy in the Old Testament, and there are frightening instances of God's judgment and wrath in the New. Any, ever read the book of Revelation, for example? And other places in the New as well. I mean, Jesus announced the doom of his generation in very terrifying terms as a judgment against them. You find judgment and mercy in both Testaments, and the God who possesses both of these qualities is an unchanging God. We certainly see a marvelous example of God's mercy toward Cain here, because Cain has done something that is worthy of death. He has killed a man. And yet God, even before Cain makes any special requests about this, God lays out a judgment that is more lenient, or more merciful, I should say, than what Cain deserves. And then Cain complains about that and appeals for a lighter sentence. And God, although he doesn't change the sentence, he says, well, I'll tell you, I'll protect you and make sure no one does you harm. I mean, just because Cain asked. The putting of a mark on Cain, by the way, is not to be seen as a judgment. That's actually as an act of mercy. The mark was so that Cain would be instantly recognizable by everyone who meets him, and they'd know, because, of course, there's only one family on the planet at that time, so, I mean, everyone, the news would spread quickly enough, even if there were hundreds of people, that Cain was marked. But his mark was in order to designate that God did not desire anyone to kill him. I wonder if the family would be suspicious about Cain's story on that. After all, this conversation took place just between Cain and God. No one else was witnessing it, as far as we know. And yet Cain saying, oh, this mark that God gave me, he says that if you hurt me, you'll be avenged sevenfold. I mean, I wonder if there were any cynics in the family who thought, yeah, so you say. You know, how do we know God did that? Maybe God put that mark on you to say that you're the guy we should kill, you know? But anyway, we have it from the Word of God itself, the inspired Word. And we know there were prophets who were hearing from God back then, Abel being one of them, that God actually did make this arrangement with Cain, and it was certainly an astonishing instance of God's grace at an early date, just as when he made skins to cover the nakedness of Adam and Eve, who might more justly have been left to their fate of embarrassment and shame, and let them struggle with leaves and try to cover their nakedness and live in this restless sense of guilt and unassuaged embarrassment. Or worse yet, he could have killed them. I mean, he said, in the day you eat of it, you shall die. They did die spiritually, but he did postpone their physical death a good long time. Some people have thought that since a day to the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day, that God said, the day you eat of it, you'll die. It just meant they died within 1,000 years, which they did. They died 930 years later. But in any case, whatever the meaning was, God did seem to extend their life longer than he was in any sense obliged to. And we see God's mercy in all the early instances of God dealing with sinners. Verse 16, then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And he built a city and called the name of that city after the name of his son Enoch. And to Enoch were born Irad, and Irad begot Mahujael, and Mahujael begot Methushael, and Methushael begot Lamech. Now, the line of Cain is here being traced. We have to remember that while these generations of Cain were coming into existence, I mean, we get about seven or so generations of Cain given, or five or six, I forget. During those generations, other things were happening in the family. I mean, Adam and Eve were having more children. Seth was growing up and having children. We read something of Seth's descendants in the next chapter. But what the Bible sometimes does is it focuses on one person's story and carries that story out a certain distance into time. And then it finishes talking about him and goes back to talk about someone else. And, of course, that retrogresses back to an earlier time than the latest time last mentioned about the previous character. You know, you go back and start at the same period again. So we have Cain's family traced for several generations. And then at chapter 5, it goes back to the earlier time and goes back to Adam and then Seth and traces Seth's generation out several generations. So here we have some of the people who descended from Cain. There is no moral assessment given of these people, his son Enoch, or his grandson Irad, or these others, Mahujael or Mahushael or Lamech. Let's leave Lamech out of this comment. These earlier names, we are not given any moral information. Were these men bad, like Cain? Were they rebels against God, or did they learn from their father's error and live righteous lives? We're not told. The net results of human society going on for generation after generation was, of course, deterioration, moral deterioration, which has led to the need for the flood in chapter 6. But we don't know that there weren't some individuals in Cain's line who might have been godly. But we are not told if there were, and therefore we cannot assume it. The next person from Cain's line we read anything about is this man Lamech. And of him it says this: Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of one was Ada, and the name of the second was Zillah. And Ada bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all those who play the harp and the flute. And as for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Then Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. O wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. Now, this is all we got about this man Lamech, and he's not to be confused with another Lamech, who is the father of Noah in chapter 5, who lived later than this Lamech. But certainly, what we read of Lamech does not endear him to us. There are some people who say, now here's a good example of how sin carries on down a family line. Cain was a sinner, killed a man. Now one of his descendants kills a man. And what's more, further sin develops in the line. We've got this man being the first polygamist. He takes two wives. Therefore, Lamech is usually remembered as an example of a bad man who sprung from bad roots, and perhaps as an example of the fact that the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, and that if a man is evil, that his sons and grandsons and great-grandsons are very possibly in danger of being evil also. However, I don't know that we have a vivid moral assessment of Lamech here. It is possible that he was a wicked and arrogant and lustful man. In fact, I wouldn't want to deny that at all, but I'm not sure that the information we have conveys that image of him as clearly as our modern Western minds would intend. The first strike against the man in our assessment is that he took two wives. We know that God did not design marriage that way. God did not intend for people to have more than one wife. Had he done so, he would have given Adam more than one wife. After all, one of the first order of business for Adam after he came into existence was to populate the earth. One of the reasons for polygamy in later society was to enhance the rate of population. Men often took additional wives. They'd take a wife, and if she was perhaps not bearing him enough children, he'd take another wife. And if she didn't bear enough, he might take another one. We might think that a man would be motivated today if he took 10 wives just simply by his insatiable lust and his desire for variety. And that might well be a correct judgment, because in modern society, children are not so much valued that men would marry enough, you know, so many wives so that they could multiply children. In ancient society, though, children were extremely valued. And the more sons in particular that a man had, the more secure he was, his position in society. First of all, he was considered to be particularly blessed by society. Secondly, strong-bodied sons, and to a lesser degree, daughters as well, in good health, could contribute to the family wealth because they could work and provide for the family and help the father in the business. And therefore, a man with many sons tended to be more wealthy. By the way, the opposite assumption exists in our society. People assume that more children is going to make you more poor, because children are represented as an expense. This is only because there is, in our day, a very potent movement in our society. It's a deliberately anti-population movement. It is part of the entire socialist, politically correct mentality that just as we are required to think certain things of a feministic sort and certain things of a socialistic sort, we're supposed to have a certain politically correct view of environmentalism. So along with that whole mindset, there's supposed to be a certain attitude toward children, namely that the world has too many of them, the population is dangerous, and one of the particular problems is that there's too much population for the food supply. Now, this, of course, assumption, if true, plays handily into the agenda of the feminists who want to liberate women from motherhood in general. And if motherhood and having children can be seen as sort of a crime against humanity because there's already too many children, that is, then the women who want to give up motherhood in favor of some other role are seen as heroes, not criminals. They're not seen as people rebelling against what God has given them to do. They're seen as people who are saving the earth. That, as I say, plays very well into the hands of the feminist agenda. The only problem is the suggestion that the earth is overpopulated is not true. I have statistical evidence of it, and there have been many studies done. There are definitely different schools of thought, and there are some who feel that since, you know, there's so many crops produced right now on the earth, and there's so many people, and the rate of increase of population is such and such that within a few years, if this doesn't change, we won't have enough food for everyone. What they don't take into consideration, which other studies do, is that with the increase of population, there's also the increase of productivity. It is a simple fact, easily calculated, that the average person produces more in their lifetime than they consume. Now, there are exceptions. There are people who don't produce anything. Big, fat, non-working, independently wealthy people who just consume, and don't produce anything of value. But they are truly exceptions. The average, ordinary person in their lifetime produce more than they consume, as seen by the fact that a great deal is given to charity. And a great deal of food is given away by the productive nations to help feed the nations less productive. And the nations that are less productive many times are not less productive because people are unproductive, but because government policies and so forth of confiscation of food. There's many socialist and communist countries that simply confiscate the goods from the people so that the leaders live like kings and the people live like paupers. And it takes away all incentive for production from the workers. And this is why communism has failed in its experiment over the past 70 years. It simply doesn't work as an economic system. People's fallen nature being what it is, people are not so philanthropic that they just want to labor 12 hours a day to produce so that the government can, you know, government officials can live comfortably and their children can starve. What I'm saying is this, that those who tell you the earth is overpopulated are speaking a party line propaganda. If you're interested, I can give you, I've even written them down, published them in one of my magazines, the statistics about how much food is produced and can be produced on the earth. They say that if you gave every person on the planet 100 square feet, I think it is, square feet, you could fit the whole planet into half of Alaska. And That would leave a lot of arable, farmable land to produce crops for those people living in half of Alaska. The population is not overburdening the world. It's true there is some waste. It is true that there is pollution. It is true that some of these things exist. But what history has shown is that as population grows and produces problems, in that population there are people who are very brilliant who come up with ways to solve problems as well. In fact, some of the problems we now have might kill us if some future geniuses don't come along who aren't born yet to solve them. The fact of the matter, from a Christian's point of view, we should say God told man and woman to populate and fill the earth. Now, some people say, well, yeah, God said to fill the earth, but it's full. I remember one Christian saying, when I tell the gas station attendant to fill up my tank, I don't mean for him to fill it up and then keep pouring gas in until it's overflowing all over the ground. Once it gets full, I don't intend to keep filling it. And God doesn't intend for us to keep filling the earth. Well, here's the thing. Who says the earth is full now? You ever flown across country and looked down below? You ever noticed how little population there is in most of the productive parts of the world? It's easy to convince the world that we're overpopulated if people live in cities, because cities clearly are overpopulated. The Bible doesn't say people are required to live in cities. It was never commanded that people live in cities. People choose to live in cities out of greed and convenience. But if people were not so motivated, there's plenty of room for all the people there are. But if you write a magazine article in Time magazine, and it's read mostly by people who live in the metropolis, where they can hardly breathe when they're walking down the street and standing in the you know, buses and in the subways, you know, there's no room. They say, boy, this is, the world really is overpopulated. But this is not an objective view of things, and it isn't true. I would say that if God told people to populate the earth and fill the earth, and he has not yet said, that's enough, then, and especially since experts do not agree that the earth is anywhere near full. In fact, some say the earth could sustain several hundred times as many populations as are here now. That's not what you populate here, because that's not politically correct. And that would suggest that it's no crime to have babies, you know, because the earth isn't really overpopulated. After all, the baby you have might end up saving the world. Never can tell. God only knows those things. Our goal is to do what God said, to value what he values, and let him take care of the consequences of our obedience. And so what I'm saying is that if a man today took two wives, or three, or four, or ten, because of the adverse feelings about children in general, we could pretty much conclude he's not doing that so they can have 10 babies every year through 10 women. But in ancient times, the opinion about babies was the opposite. The more a man had, the more wealthy he was perceived, because a child in his lifetime produces more than he consumes. Therefore, rather than being a liability, 10 children give the potential of a man's productivity and his estate growing and his wealth growing far more than if he had only 5 children, all other things being equal, or 4 or 3. So many children was desirable. And polygamy largely was practiced in societies, and still is in some societies, where children were valued, and it was largely an institution for increasing the size of a family. Certainly that's why Jacob had 4 wives. That's why Abram had 2 wives. Abram only cared about Sarah, but she couldn't have babies, so he took another one, Hagar, had a baby by her. Jacob only wanted to marry 1 woman. All he wanted was Rachel. He didn't care about anyone else. He got Leah by a bait-and-switch tactic of his uncle. And so he still wanted Rachel, so he got Leah and Rachel. He didn't want 2, but he did want the 1. And since he got another one first, he ended up with 2. We forgot the one he wanted. But then the other 2 women that bore so many of his children were just there because the wives were competing with each other to have more children. And that they were, the wives, each of them took, you know, were limited in how many children they could have, so they brought more women into the picture. And this is really how polygamy was motivated in many cases in biblical times. Furthermore, another consideration arises in Scripture, and that is in times of war. It was very typical for men, of course, to die in the battlefield, or when an army would invade a city, they'd kill all the men and take the women. They usually would not kill the women, although sometimes that happened. But women and children were often spared, but the men were often put to the edge of the sword. In days where this kind of stuff was going on all the time, it resulted in a net reduction per capita of men. And so that the numbers of women surviving in almost any society was larger, considerably larger, than the number of men. Because the men were frequently killed in war, the women were spared. So there's a situation actually described in Isaiah chapter 4, where God is talking about the total decimation of the Jewish population through war. And at the end, actually at the end of chapter 3, Isaiah 3, verse 25, God says, "Your men shall fall by the sword, and your mighty in the war." And then it says in chapter 4, verse 1, which just continues the thought, "And in that day seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, 'We will eat our own food, we'll wear our own apparel, only let us be called by your name and take away our reproach.'" Now, this is not talking about some sinful situation. This is talking about a situation where the male population has been decimated through war. Your young men have all fallen by the edge of the sword. At that time, it's like there will be seven widows. They have an estate because their husbands died and left them property. They have food, they have land, but they don't have a husband. And it's like it's saying by way of a figure of speech, the women will outnumber the men 7-1. The women would choose to share a husband rather than have none. Because to have no husband means to have no children, or to not be able to have children. I mean, now probably if the sons and husbands were killed in war, these women would have lost some of the children they already had. And in case where the women had not yet ever been married, never yet had children, they would be consigned to, if they have no husband, they can have no children. And women considered that it was not fulfilling their full potential if they don't ever have children. And so it was considered that polygamy could be a merciful thing to women in a case where there were too few men to go around because war or some other calamity had taken out the male population. That although American women, you see, we have to remember, this wasn't written to American women. American women are so independent, a lot of them don't want children, ever. And a lot of them, you know, they think they need a man about as much as a fish needs a bicycle. And so the idea of a woman living out her life without a man, or at least without a husband, is not considered to be any kind of an ultimate tragedy to our cultural way of thinking. But throughout history, and by the way, we're the strange ones, not the history. Sometimes everyone thinks, you know, well, we obviously, since we are us, we're enlightened, and everyone who thought differently in the past must have been really, you know, primitive. Maybe we're the ones who are degenerate. Throughout history, everybody, all societies agreed that a woman was disadvantaged by not being part of a family, by having no husband, by having no children. And that being so, polygamy was permitted as a means of providing husbands for women when there weren't enough husbands to go around. The women could share a husband. Now, an American woman would never tolerate such a thing. American women would say, "Well, so my husband's dead. That's a tragedy. But I'm sure not going to share a man with six other women. Better to be without a man than that." But that's because to be without a man is not considered a crisis here. It might be uncomfortable or lonely, but it's not a crisis. It's not a reproach in our society. In that society, it was. And therefore, what I'm saying to you is that polygamy was not in all respects the perversion that we might immediately think. We think of polygamy today as simply a guy not being satisfied with one woman. He wants a lot of variety of sex, so he just takes more women. And we think of it as oppressive and exploitative of women. You know, this guy's having his jollies with all these women, and what do they get out of it? They don't even get a man to call their own. They just have to share the guy with a bunch of other rivals. Now, I won't deny that polygamy has always had some of that in it. But that is not to say that polygamy came into being because of those things. A man, after all, if he wanted to be promiscuous, could just go out and sleep with prostitutes. He wouldn't have to marry them and support them and raise children by them if he didn't want to. To marry the women was an honorable thing. And in most societies, it was not considered to be immoral. It was considered to be convenience. To have more children was desirable, and there was nothing immoral about having a lot of children. And in many cases where there were too few men to go around, it was doing a favor to some of the widows or to some of the women who might otherwise never have a man, that she could at least have part of a man, she could have share him with someone else. Again, we need not judge the morality of some of these ancient institutions against the backdrop of our modern Western cultural thinking. Women and men did not always think like we do about some of these issues. Now, I say that only to say, we Westerners, we read about Lamech, and he's the first guy who takes two wives. We say, oh, man, this guy is really on the wrong path. This guy is wicked, just like his father Cain. Well, he might have been, but we couldn't judge on that basis alone, because Abram had two wives also. And Jacob had four. And Samuel's father had two wives and was a godly Jew. David had eight and Solomon had 700. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that polygamy was ever what God intended for marriage. It's clear, if God intended for marriage to be one man with several women, he could have made Adam and Eve and Sue and Mary and Alice and everyone else too. He didn't do that. Even though that would have been pragmatically and logistically a good idea if he wanted them to fill the earth, that would get the job done a lot faster. Obviously, God designed marriage to be a picture of Christ and the church, and the only clear way that marriage can do that is for there to be one man, one woman for life, committed to each other. Anything other than that mars the image of Christ and the church. It does not convey what God wanted it to convey. However, we live in a fallen society. Death exists. Therefore, widows can remarry. That mars the image, but it's not a sin. Divorce sometimes occurs. Some Christians believe divorce and marriage is always wrong. I don't believe the Bible teaches that it's always wrong. And therefore, I would say it's certainly a result of the fall. Divorce would never happen if there hadn't been a fall. But it doesn't mean that every person who is the victim of a divorce and then later remarries is doing a sinful thing. Likewise, I'm not so sure I'd say that every man who took more than one wife was committing a sin. The Bible doesn't say he was. The Bible makes it clear that just as a second marriage after widowhood, or a second marriage after divorce, or a second marriage while the first wife is still your wife, none of those things really are representative of what God wanted ideally marriage to be. The consequences of the fall sometimes allowed, and in some cases might have been required, that these subnormal marriage customs, subnormal marriage situations might exist. Marriage is not the only thing that's had to take a beating because of the fall. It's just one thing. But marriage is certainly one of those things that, because we live in a fallen world, because there is sin, because there is death, some of the things God designed to reflect perfectly a spiritual truth in an unfallen world have experienced distortion. And that doesn't mean that distortion is always, that everyone involved in that distortion is always doing something wrong. A woman who married a man who already had a wife in biblical times was not considered to be sinning. It was not considered adultery. See, most people think, well, if you have two wives, that's adultery. No, adultery is when you sleep with someone who isn't your wife and is someone else's wife. But if both people that you sleep with are your wife, then that does not fall under the category of adultery. Of course, the question of whether it's legitimate to have two women who are your wife is another story, but it's not an adultery issue. It's something else. It's a models of marriage issue. And, of course, we know that polygamy is still practiced in some cultures, non-Christian cultures, today. Christianity has always basically forbidden polygamy. That is, historically. I don't know if it did in the New Testament. We don't have any place in the New Testament or the Old that says polygamy is sin and that no godly person could ever do it. If so, that would have to condemn Moses and Abraham and Jacob and David and so many other people who actually had more than one wife. And we are not told that they did wrong. Even Isaiah seems to have had more than one wife. There's some evidence. So the Bible doesn't condemn them for this, either in the Old Testament or in the New. Paul does say that an elder of the church should be the husband of one wife, suggesting that monogamy, one husband, one wife, is the norm, and elders are supposed to be good examples of the norm of Christian life. But it does not say that Christians who have more than one, for example, the case which often happens even in modern society, a man gets converted out of Islam. Islam allows a man to have four wives. That's basically part of the religious structure. A man can have four wives if he's Muslim. Well, suppose a man with four wives as a Muslim gets saved and becomes a Christian. How do you disciple him about marriage? Now, traditionally, this kind of thing has happened when missionaries go to Africa and a tribal chieftain or someone gets saved and he's got seven wives or whatever. And what the what traditional American and English missionaries have done is they said, okay, you have to divorce all your wives except the first one you married, because everyone you married after the first was adultery. And you have to renounce that and divorce them. That's been a custom of missionaries in the past. I don't think they have any biblical basis for that. The Bible nowhere directly says polygamy is a sin. But it does say divorce is a sin. So how Christians can come into a situation where polygamy already exists in a man's life, he becomes a Christian, and then say, but you have to divorce, you know, all your wives except the first one, I don't think that has any biblical basis whatsoever. Christians aren't supposed to marry non-Christians either. But the Bible indicates that if two people are non-Christians and one gets saved, and now we have a Christian married to a non-Christian, they're not supposed to divorce. Just because that's a subnormal situation. The ideal is for Christians to be married to Christians. But if they were in this marriage before they were saved and then get saved, they're now in what is not the normative ideal marriage. But they're not supposed to divorce because of that. Likewise, if people before they're saved have multiple marriages, and then, and legitimately so, and then in their, they get converted, their marriage situation is subnormal. It's not ideal. It's not what Christians should hope for or aim for. But it doesn't mean that it's sinful and that they should divorce all their wives. They've made commitments to those women. They might have children by those women, and there's no biblical reason for them to abandon them or default on their commitments and their covenants. Now, if you ask me, do you think it's sin then for a Christian to have many wives? I would say it would be wrong for a Christian to marry multiple wives. However, I don't mean that a person who has many wives before he's a Christian and becomes saved can't be a Christian and have many wives. And that is probably why Paul had to designate that in choosing elders of the church, an elder, among other things, should be the husband of only one wife, not several. In ancient pagan societies, polygamy was practiced. Some of those polygamists probably got saved. Probably there were men in the church who had more than one wife. But Paul said, when it comes to selection of elders, don't choose them for elders. Why? Because an elder is to be a model Christian, is to model for the church what the ideal is. And certainly polygamy is not ideal. Christians should themselves always seek to live up to the ideal. We know that polygamous marriage does not reflect accurately the union of Christ and the church, and therefore we should never seek it or want it. We should want rather that our marriage life be a reflection of what God wanted marriage to reflect. And that being so, of course, polygamy would be ruled out for a Christian seeking the will of God. But it's a little bit like incest. You know, someone was asking about incest in the break. Incest today is viewed largely as exploitation of a father against his daughter, or of an older brother or a cousin against a younger relative female. And that is incest indeed, and that is sin. But biblically and legally, incest goes further to even forbid legitimate consensual marriage between people who are related to each other too closely. And someone asked her in the break, you know, is there a moral aspect of that, or is it mainly for logistic reasons? I mean, obviously there are genetic reasons why it's not advisable for people too closely related to each other to marry and have children. It is known for a fact that this results in more birth defects and so forth than marriages between people who are not so closely related result in. And my suggestion was that while we always think of incest as strictly a moral thing, if incest in itself was a moral perversion, then we could hardly imagine that God would have created the human race in such a way that required the second and third generations of humans to all have incestuous marriages. When in making only one couple, God guaranteed that their children would marry their sisters, and the next generation would have to marry cousins or someone like that. All of which was later forbidden in the law, but for what reason? Is it intrinsically immoral? If so, why did God force whole generations of humans to do that which is intrinsically moral? I don't think so. Even before the fall, God told Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. Had they never fallen and never sinned, they would have had children and their children would have married each other. There would have, of necessity, in the order of God's design, been incest of a sort, what we today call incest. But it would not have been immoral. If there had been no fall, that would not have been a sin. And even after the fall, that particular act was not a sin. What I'm saying is we need to read the scriptures, especially about ancient peoples and their marriage customs and so forth, we recognize that many of them fall short of the biblical pattern of what God prefers. But much of our judgment of them comes not so much out of biblical information as our own cultural information. You know, oh, how offensive. This man married his half-sister. Who was he? Abraham. Abraham married a daughter of his father. Had a different mother. Apparently Abram's father was a polygamist. And Abram was born from one of the wives, and Sarah was born from another, according to the Scripture. So Abram married his half-sister. This would be an abomination after the time of the law. This is incest. But the Bible nowhere indicates that God was upset with Abram for doing that, or penalized him for that, or that Abram ever had to repent of doing that, because that wasn't forbidden, and there's apparently nothing innately morally wrong with it. But, of course, there are very good reasons not to have incestuous marriage now, because the race has degenerated both spiritually and genetically to the point where such marriages are not considered safe. And it would be, to my mind, wrongheaded for a Christian to want to marry their sister or first cousin for that very reason. Just like it would be wrong, maybe for some other reasons, for a man to have several wives today. But wrong in the sense that it falls short of the standard. Not wrong in the sense that there's an actual command or some moral issue that is itself clearly violated. It's that the God has set a pattern, and Christians seek to measure up to that pattern as best they can. Because we want the will of God, we're not seeking our own will. And if a man has a wife and she produced no children to him, probably he shouldn't have taken a second wife. Probably he should have just accepted the fact that God hadn't given him any children. But if the men under that culture went ahead and took a second wife and God never forbade it, then we could say they didn't take the highest road. They didn't take the highest path. They did that which they did fall short of the mark. Shall we call that sin? Okay, if sin is missing the mark, then maybe it's sin. But is it an atrocity? Is it something that we say that tells us that that man is a moral derelict, you know? Not necessarily. When Lamech took two wives, we don't know why he took two wives. Maybe his first wife had two children and then she couldn't bear anymore. And two children was too small of a family, so he took another and she had a couple. We don't know. Now, did he deviate from God's pattern? Yes. But many righteous men deviated in that respect from God's pattern too, and we don't write them off as moral scoundrels. And so Lamech marrying two wives might or might not have been a moral scoundrel. But his polygamy certainly doesn't tell us that he was. Furthermore, we got to remember that Lamech lived, what, 5-6 generations after Adam. We don't know that he was the first polygamist. There might have been, you know, people 2-3 generations earlier practicing polygamy. He's just the first one we have any record of. We don't have the family histories of most people who lived. So we can't necessarily even say that he innovated this idea and originated polygamy. All we know is he's the first man of whom we have enough detailed record in ancient history to know that he had two wives. Now, another thing was that makes him look bad is he killed somebody. He killed a young man. He says so. However, he killed in self-defense. At a later time, even under the law, though murder was forbidden, killing in self-defense was not necessarily forbidden. And therefore, the man killed someone who was wounding him, and apparently in a life-and-death fight with him, he got a wound out of the deal and ended up killing his assailant. That doesn't make him necessarily a murderer. A lot of people don't like Lamech because of his comment, if Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. Almost sounds like a boast, they say. Cain, you know, I'm more righteous than Cain. If killing Cain would be wrong at a certain level, then killing me would be 10 times as wrong, or 70 times as wrong, or whatever, you know. Well, is he really all that mistaken in that? Cain killed a man in cold blood. Lamech killed in self-defense. His comments might be reasonable, you know. If Cain, who killed in cold blood, was nonetheless given this much mercy from God, that he God said that he would punish anyone who killed Cain, then I, who've killed in self-defense, I'm even less guilty than Cain, and anyone who kills me for this should be avenged even the more than those who killed Cain. I mean, there is, to my mind, it may be that Moses, in writing this story of Lamech, is trying to portray a corrupt man to us. But I'm not sure that the particular details given can necessarily aren't necessarily that way. I mean, there are other men. Moses killed in self-defense and had more than one wife. Shall we say the story of Moses depicts a corrupt man? Or should we just say these people lived in a less enlightened time? They didn't have the scriptures, for example. They didn't have any scriptures. Many of them probably had never laid eyes on God, never heard from God. All they knew about morality is what they picked up from their parents and grandparents and so forth, and whatever they knew in their conscience. They lived in a very unenlightened time. And all that is said about this man that we don't like it because we live in a more enlightened time. We judge him by the standards of our age. I don't know if that's a right thing for us to do. Now, I will say this. In his little poem there, in verses 23 and 24, which he spoke to his wives, we find that he was... it is said that this is the earliest known poem in history. We don't know of any poem written earlier in history that has been preserved to the present. And it is a poem, and it bears the resemblance to Hebrew poetry in general. When you read the Psalms or the Proverbs, you'll find these, as well as many other books, the book of Job and much of the material in the Prophets, are written in what we call Hebrew poetry. Now, English poetry we recognize by meter and rhyme. But Hebrew poetry is a little different. The principal feature of Hebrew poetry is not that it rhymes. It may not. But Hebrew poetry is recognized by the phenomenon of repetition or of parallelism. You will notice it in the Psalms. You'll notice it in the Proverbs. You'll notice it in Job. You'll notice it in the poetic passages of the Prophets and the other books of the Bible. And right here. There is parallelism, and that's what makes it a poem. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. O wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. It's quite clear that Ada and Zillah are the same as the wives of Lamech. And hear my voice is parallel to listen to my speech. His poem goes all the way through that way. I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. Okay, killing a man and a young man are the same thought. For wounding me, for hurting me are parallel thoughts. This is typical of Hebrew poetry, that the same thing is said twice, for emphasis and simply for aesthetic purposes. This sounded more appealing. Just like we like the way a poem rhymes, they like the way a poem restated its point another way. It's culturally very different than our method of poetry. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. This is a parallelism that develops also. In fact, here we have a very good example of what we'll see in the Psalms many times. The parallelism is sometimes not so simple as just saying the same thing twice. Notice this develops. The first couplet, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. O wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. There's an exact duplication of thought there. Wives of Lamech, Ada and Zillah, exact duplicate. Hear my voice, listen to my speech, exact duplicate. But the next one, for I've killed a man for wounding me, and then his repetition doesn't say exactly the same. He adds information. The first one didn't mention that the man was a young man. So he develops the thought in the second part of the couplet. He makes the same point, but he develops it a little bit. The man I killed, we learn in the second part of the couplet, is a young man. That's a new piece of information. In the first couplet, there was no new information. In the second couplet, the second member of the couplet actually adds some detail. And then the third couplet, which is verse 24, actually shows sort of a contrast. There's a similarity in thought, but it's more of a contrast. Cain was avenged sevenfold. I should be avenged 77-fold. You'll find those couplets of contrast lots of times in the Proverbs. You know, a wise man foresees the evil and hides himself, but the fool passes on and is punished. I mean, there's parallel of thought, but it's contrast rather than duplication. The wise man does this. The fool, in the same situation, does something different. The wise man experiences this result. The fool, this other result. But there's parallelism in thought, but it's a contrast rather than a comparison. So here we have, really, when you look at it as a Hebrew poem or song, a fairly complex development of how the parallelisms develop the thought. Now, we can go on from this, but there's a question arises: why did he sing this song to his wives? One suggestion has been made, and I don't know if it's correct, but I'll give it to you as a possibility. Someone has said that the names Ada and Zillah mean something like, I don't remember the exact translation, something like beautiful and charming, or beautiful and lovely, or something very much like that. I mean, that the names Ada and Zillah speak of the actual beauty and attractiveness of the women. And we know very well that people name their children something struck them about them at birth, and they named them according to their impressions of that child. As when Seth was born, his name means appointed. And Eve said, God has appointed me another to replace Abel, whom Cain slew. So she names him appointed. Ada and Zillah, if their names convey the notions, might have been so named because they were, in fact, unusually attractive women. Now, Lamech might have been singing this to the women in an age, because he was living in an age where society was becoming very corrupt. He was just a couple generations before the flood. Violence was great in the earth. I mean, if the only violence he ever did was killing in self-defense, that's really reasonably commendable, since the whole earth was filled with violence in those days. No doubt, sexual immorality was running amok. A man has a couple of beautiful wives. He knows there's other men out there scoping on him. And just to make sure the wives stay in line. Let me tell you something, girls. I killed a man once. He hurt me, and I killed him. You read between the lines. You know? Some have thought that there may be some of that meaning in his song. It may be. It's interesting that we have this little bit about Lamech, because he is otherwise not important in the story of the Bible in general. And we read nothing about his... we do read some things about his offspring, but we don't read anything about another generation after his offspring. His offspring, by the way, apparently were the founders of certain fields. As we read, for example, that Jabal, in verse 20, was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name Jubal, he was the father of those who play the harp and the flute. And Tubal-Cain was an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. Metal crafts, metallurgy, we would call it. Music, the development of musical instruments, and no doubt the writing of music. Possibly this is a song that Lamech himself wrote. He might have been musically inclined, and one of his sons became a craftsman in musical instruments and player of them. And one became a nomadic herdsman. One thing I just say is that when it says, he was the father of all those who live in tents, he was the father of those who do this, it doesn't mean that the offspring of this man were all musicians, or the offspring of this man were all tent dwellers. Much less does it mean that all tent dwellers were the offspring of this man. Obviously, anyone might live in a tent regardless who their father was. And anyone might learn to play a musical instrument regardless who their father was. What it is saying is, the word father is being used there the same way we say that Abraham, or that George Washington is the father of our country. Or Abraham is the father of us all. Well, in what sense? Washington's the father of our country? He's given credit for, in a large degree, for founding the country. To say Abraham is the father of us all, as the New Testament says, means that he was the example that we follow. He had a faith that saved him. We have a faith like his. In that sense, we're his children, and he's our father. The word father is used in a non-literal sense often in Scripture and in speech generally. And what it means here is he was the founder of that particular lifestyle. He was the first to do it. Those who came afterward could be seen as imitating him, just as children imitate their father. They learn their father's trade. Those who make musical instruments are imitators of Jubal, because he was the first to do it. He was the father of all those who do that. It does not mean he was the biological progenitor of all of those who do those things. We need to become acquainted with the Hebrew idioms, because we're going to run into them all the way through the Old Testament. Verse 25, and Adam knew his wife again. This does not mean that this was simply the third time. We know from chapter 5 and verse 3 that this particular knowing of his wife happened when he was 130 years old. And I seriously doubt if two virile adults, probably the most attractive adults who've ever lived, since they were perfect before their fall, equipped and commanded to fill the earth, it's hard to imagine they'd have three children and then stopped having sex until they were 130 years old. This event we read of in verse 25 did happen when Adam was 130, because we're told that in Genesis 5:3, when the story is retold. But Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth, which means appointed. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed, she said. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. And Enosh means mortal man or something like that. Then men began to call on the name of Jehovah, the name of the Lord. Now, what's that mean? What does it mean, men then began to call the name of Jehovah? Does that mean that they never knew God by that name before? Well, the name Jehovah is found back even when Cain was born. In verse 1 of chapter 4, she says, I've obtained a man from Jehovah. So certainly the name Jehovah was not revealed for the first time in the lifetime of Enosh. Over 100 years earlier, Eve had made reference to God by that name. So what does it mean that in the days of Enosh, men began to call on the name of the Lord? Well, maybe there was a general revival of people turning back to God in the days of Enosh. There might even be the implication, though it can't be stated categorically without question, but it may be implied that Enosh had something to do with this. He might have been a prophet. Abel had been a prophet. Seth was a replacement for Abel. Perhaps Abel's anointing came on Seth and his son too. We don't know. I'm only conjecturing, but there's some reason why we are told that in the days of Enosh, men began to turn to the Lord. Maybe he had some influence on them. Maybe he was a preacher of righteousness like one of his later descendants, Noah, was. Because Noah was descended from this family also. We don't know, but it certainly what we see is an apparent contrast between the family of Cain in verses 16 through 24 and the family of Seth in verses 25 and 26. Although very little detail is given about either, in general, Cain's family isn't rising very far above Cain himself, perhaps. Maybe a bit. But let's just put it this way. While the things we are told about Lamech do not necessarily mark him as an extraordinarily bad man, the things we're told about him don't necessarily mark him as an unusually good man either. Whereas what we're told about Seth is that he's a replacement for Abel. Well, that's good. Abel is a good man. And his son, during his day, men began to call in the name of the Lord. That would hardly be worthy of mention unless Enosh either had some role in turning men to the Lord, or else he at least was among those who turned to the Lord when that happened in his day. In other words, we're given sort of a thumbnail sketch of these two families here. The family of Cain and the family of Seth. But in chapter 5, we're given a much larger treatment of Seth's family. And really it starts at Adam again, then it runs through Seth and then to Enosh and then on beyond that for another seven generations. And it takes us up to Noah. We find that Noah was directly descended from Seth. And the generations that spanned the time from Adam to Noah, which was at least 1,500 years, are recorded in chapter 5. Chapter 5 is one of those chapters that people usually think of as a boring chapter in the Bible. When people want to characterize, you know, the epitome of a boring passage of Scripture, they say, all those begots. So-and-so begot, so-and-so begot, so-and-so begot, so-and-so. Boring. Well, believe it or not, even these passages, which might strike us as boring, have a lot of lessons in them. I heard of a case of a man who got saved reading this chapter. I'll tell you why in a moment. Well, let's look at the chapter. I'd like to read it. There will be some redundance. But it is that very redundance that I want you to take note of. It says, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them and called them Adam in the Hebrew. Here it's translated mankind because man, Adam means man, and it can also mean mankind. But it says God called them, Adam and Eve, Adam, in the day that they were created. And Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he begot sons and daughters, so all the days of Adam that he lived were 930 years and he died. Seth lived 105 years and begot Enosh. After he begot Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and begot sons and daughters, so all the days of Seth were 912 years and he died. Enosh lived 90 years and begot Cainan. And after he begot Cainan, Enosh lived 815 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. Cainan lived 70 years and begot Mahalalel. After he begot Mahalalel, Cainan lived 840 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Cainan were 910 years, and he died. Mahalalel lived 65 years and begot Jared. After he begot Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years, begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years, and he died. Now, I won't read every verse in this chapter, because I've read enough to illustrate what I want to point out. That it gives, in spanning 10 generations from Adam to Noah, it gives a sort of a little paragraph about each generation. And it does so in a very symmetrical way. Each paragraph follows a certain paradigm. Basically, it tells how old a man was when his first son was born. Then it tells us how many years he lived after his son was born, and tells us that he also had sons and daughters besides. Then it totals up the number of years, the number before his son was born, the number after, and gives the sum total of his life, and then it says, and he died. There's only one exception to this in the whole thing, and that is Enoch, which we'll consider in a moment. In verse 21, Enoch didn't die. But apart from Enoch, all of these men died. And I said that I met somebody, or heard of a man from somebody who knew him, who had given his life to the Lord for reading this very chapter. Because as an unbeliever, he decided to read through the Bible, and he got this far, and he read, and so-and-so lived so-and-so, and all the years lived so-and-so, and he died. And so-and-so, 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 and he died. And so-and-so did so-and-so, and he died. And he got it through his head, he died, he died, he died. And then he said, hey, I'm going to die. Everyone dies. And it just awakened him to the fact that death was a universal experience. And that was the first time it really came to him that he was going to die, and he'd better get ready to die. And he turned his life over to God. Now, if a chapter like this has the potential of turning someone to the Lord, think of the power in the other passages of Scripture. There's more, however, to this chapter. It has been said that if you take the translation of the various names and add them up, they make an interesting message. Now, this is a bit tenuous. And so I want to present it to you with exactly the status that it holds. I have heard from several sources that what I'm about to say is true. I've done the research myself to see if it is true. And I've been able to confirm part of it, maybe 60% of this from my own research. The other 40% I've simply not been able to confirm. So I can't say for sure that this is true, but it's rather interesting. It is said that if you take the 10 names in this chapter, the 10 generations, that you'll find an interesting message when you take the meaning of those names. The first name, of course, is Adam in verse 3. Then Seth in verse 6. In verse 9, Enosh. Verse 12, Cainan. Verse 15, Mahalalel. Verse 18, Jared. Verse 21, Enoch. Verse 25, Methuselah. Verse 28, Lamech. Not the same Lamech as the previous chapter. And verse 32, Noah. Now, people named their children significant names in those days. It wasn't just they liked the sound of a name, but they actually picked a name that they thought was either prophetic or somehow appropriate for the child. Moses was named Moses because that word sounds like the Egyptian word for drawing. And the daughter of Pharaoh said, I drew him out of the water, so I'll call him Moses, drawing. And so forth. I mean, names, Seth, names appointed, because God gave me another, appointed me another to replace Abel, whom Cain slew. This is typical practice in ancient times. And we have to remember that to us, Adam, Seth, Enosh, Cainan, Mahalalel, Jared, and so forth are just words. They're not in our language. They're just proper names. But in Hebrew, these are actual names, words that mean something. Just like Adam is a word that means man. And Seth is a Hebrew word that means appointed. These are actual words that in their language, they would not just see this as a proper name, they'd actually see this, they'd know the meaning of the name. Therefore, an ancient person reading this chapter in the Hebrew and taking the meaning of each name, which they would recognize, would possibly see something ingenious here. Adam means man. And as we've already said, Seth means appointed. Enosh, it would appear, means mortal or mortal man. If you skip down to verse 15, Mahalalel, I skipped over Canaan for a reason. Mahalalel means blessed God. And Methuselah, according to many accounts, means his death shall bring it. Noah, in verse 32, means comfort. This much can be determined pretty much beyond question. These are meanings of names widely and recognized. There are some names here whose meanings are not as easy to confirm. For instance, one very well-known pastor said he had looked these up, and he had not found all these meanings in one source, but he had to use several sources, because sometimes a name is given or thought to have more than one meaning. But he said all of these names he found confirmed in some lexical sources. Verse 12, Kainan, he said, means shall suffer. Perhaps implying he shall suffer. But, and maybe his parents named him that because he was sickly, or they could tell that he was deformed, or some way or another he's going to suffer. But his name, it is said, means shall suffer. Jared, this pastor said, means came down. Actually, my research has not been able to confirm that exact tense, that is past tense, but I looked it up and I found in the Hebrew lexicons it means something like descending or descended or something like that. It has to do with the Hebrew word to descend or come down. So I was able to confirm that generally. Enoch, in verse 21, this pastor said means teaching. Now, I believe that when I looked this up in the Hebrew, I could only find confirmation for it means something like initiated or initiating. Now, initiating can mean teaching. And so, there's a closeness there. I'm saying that I can't prove all these points. I have looked them up, and I have confirmed about 60% of this. There's about 40% I can't. In verse 28, Lamech was said to mean despairing. But the name Lamech means despairing. Now, if this is true, if we accept these meanings, and like I said, about 6 out of the 10 I have confirmed for my own study, the other 4 I have to trust others who say they've done the study, and I have found even in some of those cases, in two of those 4, I have found very close in my research closeness to what these other men have said. So it's sort of like I've confirmed maybe 75%. But if that is the meaning of these words, then it means that Adam means man, Seth means appointed, Enosh means mortal man, Cainan means shall suffer, Mahalalel means blessed God, Jared means came down, Enoch means teaching, Methuselah means his death shall bring, Lamech means despairing, and Noah means comfort. And anyone can see by scanning down the list of those meanings that if that is the meanings the original readers would recognize those names, you have a succinct presentation of the gospel. That Adam appointed that mortal man shall suffer. The blessed God came down teaching that his death shall bring the despairing comfort. That would be the essential structure of the meaning of those words. Now, of course, someone could suggest, well, doesn't that maybe suggest that this genealogy is a fiction and that Moses or whoever wrote it made up these names in order to have these meanings? Hardly likely. The idea that God would come down and die and bring comfort to despairing man was hardly understood in Old Testament times. That was not even understood by the disciples until after it happened. This is something that if it was concocted by any mind, it must be in the mind of God. Because these people named their children for their own reasons. Eve named Seth appointed not because she wanted that to be part of the whole structure of this chapter 5. She didn't know what Seth would name his child or what his grandchild would be named or anything. She named him that for her own reasons. Each of these people was named by their parent for various reasons of their own. In fact, Methuselah, meaning his death shall bring it, was named by his father Enoch, a prophet, probably with reference to the death of Methuselah would bring the flood. Because we find that Methuselah died when the flood came, died in the same year. after living longer than any other recorded lifetime. What I'm saying is that those parents who named their children these things did so for individual reasons in each generation. But when you look at the span of the 10 generations, it would appear that there was a divine mind behind this history, guiding the naming of these children. Are there any pieces missing that you guys didn't get down in your notes? Okay. Mahalalel means blessed God. Jared means came down. Enoch means teaching. Methuselah, his death shall bring. Lamech, despairing. Okay, and Noah means comfort. All you have to do is fill in a few articles, the, and so forth, and you get a sentence there. If you, the whole story being Adam appointed, mortal man shall suffer. Blessed God came down, teaching, his death shall bring despairing comfort. Add a few thes in the proper places, and you've got a sensible sentence there. Not only sensible, but a remarkable sentence, because it seems to foresee and foretell the gospel long before even the flood. Now, there are a couple of other things of interest to say about this chapter. You might start looking at genealogies with a new interest after this in these boring chapters of the Bible. But in verses 21 through 24, we have the story of Enoch. And his story reads a little differently than the others. It says, Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. After he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Then it goes on to talk about Methuselah. Now, given the paradigm that each of the previous and following paragraphs follow in telling about a man and his sons and his daughters and so forth, in the paragraph about Enoch, the reference to his death is conspicuous by its absence. Because it is said again and again of each one, and he died, and he died, and he died. But Enoch, he didn't die. He walked with God, and God took him. Now, of course, took him, I suppose, if we had no other information, we could interpret that as he died. It is possible to understand that when a person dies, that God took him. And if we didn't know otherwise, we might think, well, Enoch also died. In fact, he died young. He died younger than everyone else. He was only 365 years old. Everyone else was in their 900s. Maybe this would be saying, some might assume, again, if we had no further information about it, maybe this would assume that he died young, and since that was not a natural death, it came much earlier than a natural death for anyone else around his time, that it was a special case of God just taking him, you know. When my wife was killed at age 27, I would be inclined to say, God took her. God took her home, you know. Of course, if she died at age 99, I'd probably still say God took her, but it would be more, she died, died of natural causes. From the Christian point of view, when a saint dies, God took them. And therefore, one might conclude, as I say, if they had only this chapter gone, that Enoch simply died prematurely of unnatural causes, so that his death is not recorded like the others who lived out a long lifetime, but he was taken early by God. However, in the New Testament, we are told that Enoch actually didn't die. In Hebrews chapter 11, in the faith chapter, as we have called it, Hebrews 11, verse 5 and 6, says, by faith Enoch was translated so that he did not see death. The word translated means something like transported, transferred from one realm to another. It's a term that is also used in theology of the rapture, when the church is caught up to meet the Lord in the air. That is often referred to as the translation of the saints. Enoch was translated so that he did not see death and was not found because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must first believe that he is or exists and that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Enoch was translated. He was caught up alive. He did not see death. He didn't die. God took him alive, apparently, into heaven. What transformation may have occurred to his body so that he could dwell in heaven instead of on earth, we are not told. When we are translated, when Jesus comes back, our bodies will put on immortality, and this mortal, this corruption shall put on incorruption, and possibly that happened to Enoch as well. We don't know. But he is unique in this chapter. In 10 generations, over 1,500 years, he's the only man, in fact, not only during that time, but any time since, who did not die. Now, some think that Elijah didn't die, and it's possible that he did not. The Bible doesn't state it in so many words. The Bible talks about how a flaming chariot came down, picked up Elijah, and carried him off into heaven. That he survived this trip seems to be implied. But it doesn't specify that he didn't die. He could have died and gone to heaven. I don't know that I'd survive a ride in a flaming chariot, but he could if God wished it. In any case, we know Enoch didn't die. We suspect Elijah did not also. But there's more about Enoch of interest in the New Testament. In the book of Jude, which is just before the book of Revelation, it says in verse 14, Jude only has one chapter, Jude verse 14 and verse 15 says, "Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also, saying, Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him." Now notice, Enoch was a prophet. Enoch the seventh from Adam, he was a prophet. And he prophesied about wicked men being judged. He prophesied about the Lord coming in judgment upon the wicked to wipe them all out. Now Jude said that there were wicked men in his own day, in Jude's day, you know, thousands of years after Enoch's time, who were also included in this prophecy of Enoch. He says Jude, Enoch also prophesied about these men, meaning the men that Jude has been describing who were around in his own day. But he says he also prophesied about these men. It might mean that Enoch's prophecy principally was to his own generation, but additionally his prophecy applies to these men in Jude's generation. It is entirely possible that Enoch was prophesying the judgment of the flood. Now you say, but it says the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. Yeah, the term is used figuratively in the Bible frequently. Even at Mount Sinai, Deuteronomy says God came with 10,000 of his saints there. But a great judgment from God is often referred to as a visitation from God, or God coming in judgment in the Old Testament. And it's possible that Enoch, in giving this prophecy, had as his primary emphasis the wicked men of his generation, of his day, were going to be judged when God comes in judgment, and that was fulfilled in the flood. Jude says that this prophecy also extends beyond that to the people of Jude's own day, and they were judged also, apparently, shortly afterwards, but we'll talk about that another time when we talk about Jude. But what we do get from this New Testament information is something we didn't even know in the Old Testament, and that's Enoch was a prophet. And he prophesied judgment, very possibly the judgment of the flood. Well, maybe we would have gotten that impression without the New Testament telling us that. Because if, in fact, the name Methuselah means his death shall bring something. And if, in fact, we read that Methuselah died, if you calculate the years of his life and of the later generations, that he died the same year the flood came, then his death shall bring means his death shall bring the flood or the judgment. Well, who named Methuselah that anyway? His father Enoch did. Enoch was a prophet. Enoch predicted judgment, according to the book of Jude. And in addition to uttering the prophecy that Jude records from Enoch, apparently Enoch set a time limit for the judgment. When his son was born, he prophesied, "When this boy dies, it will come. His death will bring it." And since he doesn't specify what it will bring, it may be assumed that he had already spoken about what judgment is going to come, and he simply says that it will come when my son dies. Interestingly, God extended the life of Methuselah longer than any other known recorded lifespan because of God's own reluctance to bring judgment, knowing that when he died, it would be sent. But Enoch serves as a very enlightened man in very ancient times. He knew almost 1,000 years before the flood, to be exact, 969 years before the flood, that his son would die and the flood would come then. And Enoch prophesied there would be a great judgment where God would destroy all the ungodly this may have yet another fulfillment in the second coming of Christ, where all the ungodly will be wiped out then too. But it seems likely that Enoch was given that prophecy for his generation and was fulfilled, at least in the first sense, in the judgment that God brought on his generation of wicked people, or his sons and grandsons' generation of wicked people. So we have here Methuselah, a very interesting name connected with the time of the flood. We have Enoch, interesting person, a prophet, and he didn't die. Some people think Enoch still has to die. It says in Hebrews chapter 9, it is appointed unto man once to die. And therefore, since Enoch has missed his appointment, since it's appointed for everyone to die, he must come back and die later. There are people who say the same thing about Elijah. Both Elijah and Enoch, they say, didn't die, and it's appointed to man once to die, so they've got to come back so they can die. And based largely on this kind of argument, some have identified Enoch and Elijah with the two witnesses in Revelation chapter 11. Because those two witnesses prophesy for 3.5 years and then they get killed. And one of them resembles in his behavior Elijah, although he's not identified in the Bible with Elijah. Some say, well, Elijah's one of them and Enoch's the other, and they come back to be killed because they didn't die when they lived before. And God preserved them alive so that he could bring them back and they could die later. The only problem, well, there's more than one problem with this identification. One is that the only reason anyone could conceive of for bringing Enoch into Revelation chapter 11 is the fact that he happens to be one of the two guys who didn't die. And that there may be reasons for identifying one of those two witnesses with Elijah. And since Elijah is the other guy who didn't die, they figure, well, the other unnamed witness probably is also Enoch. But the problem here is the suggestion that Enoch and Elijah must necessarily die, based upon the statement in Hebrews chapter 9, it is appointed unto men once to die. It should be understood more correctly, it is appointed unto men, generally speaking, once to die. But there will be many people who don't die. Paul said that twice. He said, behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, he means die, but we shall all be changed, in 1 Corinthians 15:50. And in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, he says, we who are alive and remain at the coming of the Lord shall be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. Not all of us will die. Though it is appointed unto men once to die, that is a generality. Generally speaking, all people die, and they die only once. That's the point. But that doesn't mean there can be no exceptions. God did not make Elijah die, probably. God did not make Enoch die, we know for sure. And he's not going to make many people die who are alive at the coming of Christ. Therefore, the statement that, you know, Enoch must come back to die because he didn't die yet, and everyone has to, is simply not very well thought out and is seemingly misinformed. Now, we need to move on to chapter 6 only to give an introduction to it. Once again, I said it'd be nice to get to the end of the chapter in a session here. We're not going to do it this time. Chapter 6 is full of significance and will require more comments than can be made in a single session. So I might as well borrow some of the time from this session so that we can make some headway on it and possibly finish chapter 6 in the next session. Chapter 6 says, now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man, whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I've made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. We were introduced to Noah at the end of chapter 6, and we're told that we're told in verse 32 that he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We now learn that Noah, something we weren't told in chapter 5, Noah was a godly man and found favor in the sight of God. Elsewhere in Scripture, in the New Testament, we're told that he was even a preacher of righteousness. Now, I read this because this leads up to the announcement that there's going to be a flood. In verse 9, which is the next verse after where we stopped, we're going to read something about God appearing. Shortly after that, at least, we read that God tells Noah there's going to be a flood and tells him to build an ark. But the first eight verses kind of lead up to this and tell us what precipitated that. One thing we see is that the flood was going to come and destroy the earth because God was sorry he'd made man. Does this mean God was admitting he'd made a mistake to make man, or that God didn't know in advance that man would turn out this bad, and God didn't know the future, and this took him by surprise? Not necessarily. Many things make me sorry that aren't so much of a surprise. You can anticipate, for example, that someone you love, your parents, are going to die. You know that's going to happen, but when it happens, you'll still be sorry. It doesn't mean it was unanticipated. It just means that when it happens, it's not very happy, not a very happy occurrence. And God certainly knows enough of the future to know that man was going to turn out this way. But it didn't make him any happier for knowing it in advance. When it happened, it made him sorry. He was sorry that he had made man. Man's creation had brought sorrow to God. It grieved him at his heart, it says in verse 6. And God decided that he'd start over again with one man and one family, as he had done in the Garden of Eden. And he'd start with a good man this time. And so he was going to wipe out all the rest and basically take the human race back to approximately the same place it was when it started, with a single family, single couple and their children. And this was hopefully going to make a better world. And it did for a while, a little bit. But it would certainly clean the world. You know, we think, well, gosh, the world's so bad today. If God's tolerating it now, why didn't he tolerate it then? It's possible the world is much, much worse even then than it is now. We don't know. It says every thought of and intent of a man's heart was only evil continually. That may not be true of every person at every time, but that was the case back then. The earth was filled with violence. It's a terrible situation. We're not given much detail about it, but we can only imagine it. If God has tolerated our society as corrupt and violent as it is, and he didn't tolerate this society back then, it was very possibly considerably worse than anything we have personally seen. But what caused things to get so bad? I said earlier that just living a long time, a sinner has a long time for sin to develop and grow up and dominate his life. And it was a merciful thing that we don't live so long now if we're living in sin, because it will eventually, it ruins most people's lives before they reach 70. And if it kept progressing to age 700 or 900, imagine how bad it could get. Well, that in itself would have probably eventually led to a very utterly corrupt society, just that people lived long in their sins. But there is something else related to it here. And we read of it in verse 2. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful, and they took wives of them of as many as they wished. And this is apparently told as part of the reason that things turned out as badly as they did. It would appear that this story about the sons of God taking the daughters of men somehow contributes to the degeneration of the society. And God, because of this, I'll talk about that in a moment, in verse 3, God decided he was only going to give mankind another 120 years. Now, when it says his days shall be 120 years in verse 3, it doesn't mean that God was going to reduce the lifespan of people from 900 to 120. That did not happen. First of all, it never happened. After the flood, for several generations more, people lived to be 400 or 500 years, for generations after the flood. Then it came down lower. By Abraham's day, he lived about 175. And then it came down lower and lower until in the days of David, the average age was about 70. 70, David said in the Psalms. And therefore, we don't ever have a time before or after this that God had the average lifespan of man be 120 years. It is better to understand this to mean that from the time God made this determination, mankind would have another 120 years before the flood would come. Now, this may mean that God made this announcement to Noah at this time, because God certainly knew longer before the flood than that, that he was going to send the flood. Back when Methuselah was born, God knew this flood would come, and that was 969 years before the flood. But it may be that the 120 years marks the time before the flood that God actually announced to Noah that he'd better build an ark. It is believed by many that Noah was given 120 years notice of the flood, and that it was coming. That the verse 3 is essentially part of what God communicated to Noah, the prophet. communicated it to someone, obviously, and Noah was probably the man. So probably from the time God spoke to Noah about this, which we haven't even read about him doing yet, it was another 120 years before the flood actually came. Now, what about these sons of God and daughters of men? There's a couple of major theories about this. One would make the sons of God out to be angels. The angels apparently are sometimes called sons of God. In the first two chapters of Job, there's a few times that refers to the sons of God, and most understand this to mean the angels. And therefore, when it says the sons of God saw the daughters of men, it is suggested by many that we're talking about superhuman beings becoming attracted to female human beings, daughters of men, finding them attractive and marrying them. And it is thought that there is certainly some unnaturalness in this union, because it says in verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days and also afterward. And so some say that these giants, actually the Hebrew word is Nephilim, which no one knows the exact translation of because it only appears one other place in all of Hebrew literature. The word Nephilim in all known Hebrew literature, the Bible and outside the Bible, only appears twice. It appears in this verse, there were Nephilim in the world in those days. And again, it appears in Numbers 13:33, where the Jews who spied out the land and brought back a report in the days of Moses said, we saw Nephilim in the land, and we were like grasshoppers compared to them. Based on the fact they said we were like grasshoppers compared to them, it is assumed by translators that Nephilim, whatever it means, must mean something very big. And so it's translated giants, traditionally. But giant what? Giant men? Or giant monsters? Dinosaurs, maybe? Who knows? There were big things, big giant things, Nephilim, in the earth in those days. And all we know about them, that we don't know etymologically, there's not enough occurrences in Hebrew literature to know exactly what the word means, but whatever Nephilim were, they were big because people felt like insects next to them. Now, that might suggest just big men like Goliath, who stood about 9.5 feet tall. If that's true, then for people to say we felt like insects next to them, like grasshoppers, is a hyperbole, a slight exaggeration. Still might be the case that they would use such a hyperbole. If a 5-foot man stood next to a 10-foot man, he might feel like an insect. Although it's possible that the Nephilim were not even human, that they were animals or something. Now, the point here is that the Bible does not say that the Nephilim were the offspring of these marriages. It is the assumption that the Nephilim are in fact the offspring of these marriages that has led some people to think this must be supernatural or unnatural marriages. Angels marrying people. But that is not stated. It is not stated that these Nephilim were the offspring of the marriages. It just says there were Nephilim on the earth in those days. It says, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them. It almost sounds like the Nephilim were there before and after these marriages. We know this, that all the children of these marriages were destroyed in the flood. And yet after the flood, Nephilim were around again in the land of Canaan, and the Jews saw them. So how did the Nephilim, who were all killed in the flood, end up in the land of Canaan later, if indeed the production of Nephilim requires angels to marry women? On the other hand, if Nephilim were just big men or big something else, then their ancestors may well have survived on the ark. So we don't know what the Nephilim are, but there's certainly no reason to insist that they are the offspring of these marriages. And only the insistence that these are the offspring of those marriages is the strongest argument for there being a supernatural or unnatural kind of marriage spoken of here. The other view is that the sons of God are people. In fact, probably the people mentioned in chapter 5, the family of Seth, which were godly. We don't know that all of them were godly, but all the ones we know anything about were godly. Enosh and his day men turned to Jehovah. Enoch walked with God and was not. Noah found grace in the sight of the Lord. We don't know much about the others, but we don't know anything bad about them. All that we know about the family of Seth is that God somehow blessed and associated himself with certain individuals in his family. And they might well in their generations, in a world of corruption, been viewed as the children of God or the people of God. And for these men to begin to marry outside the faith, to begin to marry the daughters of men who were not godly, would be to become unequally yoked together with unbelievers, as the New Testament forbids Christians to do. And this breakdown of the godly line could easily result in the utter corruption of the race. The salt of the earth loses its savor by intermixing, and then the corruption and rot goes further. So there are two views on this. One is that the sons of God are angels who fell, and married women. The other is that the sons of God are simply godly people who eventually married women not based on their godly compatibility, but based on their looks. They saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful to look at and took wives. Either is possible. The one suggests a supernatural and unnatural kind of joining. The other simply is interreligious marriage, interfaith marriage. And that is not a good thing. Interfaith marriage is not good. The Bible forbids it. And when it happened here, if that's what is described here, it simply meant that no families remained intact who were godly. There were simply the integrity of a godly line that were serving as salt and light in the earth broke down. And that only added to the corruption of the world and advanced it at a greater rate. We might have more to say about this later. We have to stop here because the time has run out. There are considerations on each side of that question. The main one being that angels don't marry, Jesus said, and these sons of God married. But we don't have time to go into all the pros and cons of these arguments right now. We'll simply say there are two theories about the sons of God and leave it at that for the moment. Okay, stop there. And anyone have comments or questions?